This is your go-to podcast dedicated to getting the exclusive scoop from the industry's top influencers that are helping to shape the cybersecurity, audit, and IT governance landscape. Tune in as we dig deep and learn their motivators, explore their industry journey, and investigate their ideas and predictions on what the future holds. This is Isaka's Cyber Pros. Welcome to the show.
Hi, my name is John Brandt. I'm the Information Security Professional Practices Lead here at Isaka. You'll notice here we have a little change of host here with the this particular podcast, just like everything else, just a little shuffling of the responsibilities here at Isaka. I have oversight of the InfoSec portfolio, work across with my colleagues across the company, delivering content creation and subject matter expertise for various InfoSec-related things. October was Cybersecurity Awareness Month here in the United States, and it's hard to believe it's already November, right? For my United States colleagues here and listeners, you know, here we have a lot of awareness months. There seems to be for everything. And as I was kind of combing through what I was going to talk about, which was originally going to be workforce related, because that's really where I kind of geek out on the types of things to kind of help knock down some barriers and have these hard conversations that need to be had so we could kind of increase the talent pipeline. But what struck my interest here is this week, Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency released a directive titled Reducing Significant Risk of Known Exploited Vulnerabilities. And I really felt that that was a more immediate need. And even though this is U.S.-centric, there is some global applicability here. So for my global listeners and watchers, I just ask that you bear with me here. I think that I'm going to provide some good context or whatnot. And if you have any feedback or whatnot, you reach out after the fact and you know, we could continue the dialogue. It being November, what I learned was that we have Infrastructure Security Month, right? And so this press release went out by the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency on November 1st. And it's asking organizations of all kinds to learn about their shared responsibility in critical infrastructure security and how they could build it in. They've got weekly themes and whatnot. And I use this as a segue and opener from Cybersecurity Awareness Month to Infrastructure Security Month. Obviously, this has been first and foremost on a lot of people's minds this year. Just a lot has happened in the critical infrastructure realm. And there are these conversations that need to be had, and most notably because it's not just a governmental problem. And I think that's really where I want to focus on coming out of the gate here, is acknowledging that. You know, I talked about what the title of the directive is, and you know, you can find it online as for yourself, and we can provide a link to it. But this order, what I found was this binding operational directive is compulsory direction to federal executive branch departments and agencies. It does not apply to the Department of Defense or intelligence community here in the U.S. When I started reading the directive and preparing for this podcast, something really struck me odd. And to be honest with you, it frustrated me that the government here has to mandate to any agency to really to do their job, right? And there's really no other way to kind of put that than to start there is cybersecurity, or in the broader sense, information security, none of this is new. We've been protecting information since the beginning of time in different forms. Again, cyber has been mainstream for a while, and it's frustrating that we have to have, you know, anybody from the President of the United States on down to major agencies to kind of issue these directives. You shall do your job. It just really, it strikes a really bad nerve with me in this. Within the directive, and we're just going to talk about some of these highlights here, is required actions. Within 60 days of issuance, agencies shall review and update your vulnerability management processes. If requested, the agencies need to provide a copy of what those policies and procedures are. So right off the bat, if you don't already have something in play, it probably explains why CISA had to come out and mandate something, which is disturbing by itself. There's some subparts to that. It talks about if you don't have it, or you do, they're expecting you to basically recheck your stuff and make sure that you have a process for ongoing remediation vulnerabilities. That's pretty, Mark 1, Mod 0 type at the root of all cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is technical risk. You know, this is what we exist to do, is to basically mitigate any risk that exists out there, with whether it's systems, applications, or whatnot. Assign roles and responsibilities. Boy, that's pretty earth-shattering there, right? Define necessary actions required to enable prompt response. Establish internal validation and enforcement procedures, internal tracking and reporting requirements. The second action of this is to remediate in accordance with the timeline set forth. At the time of this recording, there were 291 vulnerabilities that are being tracked by CISA that date back to 2010. So 11 years now, almost 12 years worth of vulnerabilities that are out there. And potentially there's agencies that have not complied with any of them. So for those 291 vulnerabilities, if they apply to you, it does kind of boggle the mind whether any of these, the agencies in the target of the directive, if they even know what they have, because to look at 291 vulnerabilities, they don't apply to every operating system, every kind of platform, every kind of software. So first and foremost, you need to know everything you have, which is a core component of security, because you can't protect what you don't know what you have. For vulnerabilities that have been cataloged by CISA prior to 2021, you have 2 weeks to remediate them. Now, if you don't have any kind of security program or whatnot, this is going to be a sizable lift, you know, rightfully so. It's hard to imagine that CISA is not going to be double checking some of this stuff. I am aware they do some, they do scanning of the enterprise. Those are typically public facing scans, is my understanding of that. So I'm a big believer, right, of this trust but verify, and, you know, which is a core kind of underpinning concept in why zero trust is gaining popularity. Is obviously there's a lot of agencies that had not done everything they needed to do, because had they done that, this directive would have never been necessary in the first place. So I would expect that some kind of validation or some kind of extra, you know, CISA directed audit to come out and kind of verify what they say is true is actually holding up. For new vulnerabilities, they're saying you have 6 months to remediate. You know, I recognize in the public space, things move a lot slower. And, you know, my background, I have 20 years in the Navy, specifically supporting the intelligence community. I've been the information security manager on a flow. I understand a lot of the red tape and some of the nuances with systems that others put on board and whatnot. I like to believe that we've come a lot further. But when I see directives like this, it's kind of hard not to be skeptical. The third one is reporting on the status of vulnerabilities. And they talk about this dashboard here in beginning October 1 of 2022. So they're giving you 11 months to get to a point of to get everybody in and to be reporting this stuff. That prior role I had talked about when as an information security manager, I did it on an aircraft carrier. There was reporting requirements. Obviously, I'm assuming, you know, things are a little bit more centralized here. But again, that was within the Department of Defense construct. This here's all your other federal agencies outside of that. So it looks like they're starting to put some lateral limits on reporting and trying to normalize operations. It will be interesting to follow, though. But through this, you know, that's just the directive as a starting point. And it really brings up a bigger conversation here. For those that are outside of the United States, CISA is heavily involved, right, on within overseeing everything coast to coast. But there's this large emphasis, rightfully so, on critical infrastructure. And as I kind of started to gather my thoughts and how I wanted to take this podcast and what I thought would be value added, regardless of where you are in the world, You have to, there's some logical questions that kind of came to mind here. And, you know, when we look at this word, you know, I stress this compulsory directive. And that there kind of, because they underlined it, right? And it was hyperlinked to another reference document. And it kind of just made me wonder why. And through this, as I, you know, a couple mouse clicks here and there and some Google recon, like, you know, any of us do, I found this article published by the Federal Aviation Administration in March of 2020. So about a year and a half ago. And it was published by the person who created the blog or the article, whatever you want to call it, was the what they call the Plain Language Program Manager. And I thought that was kind of intriguing, right? And for a couple of thoughts. One is this particular post was talking about, and it was titled, "What's the only word that means mandatory?" And it goes on, here's what law and policy say about shall, will, may, and must. And I found this intriguing. And again, I'm not sure, this may not be applicable across the globe. It could be. It's obviously an issue here in the United States because in my time in the federal market, the word shall was always, was inferred in what it was taught to me was that you will do. There's no, you cannot pass go. You don't have the option of doing it. But come to find out, that's actually not true here. And there's a legal writing scholar that was referenced here, Brian Garner, and an editor of the Black's Law Dictionary. It says, in most legal instruments, shall violates the presumption of consistency, which is why the word shall is among the most heavily litigated words in the English language. So the first universal takeaway, regardless of who you work for, what geographic location, what country or, you know, government type is, words matter. And especially in the context of things where you're looking for mandatory enforcement and kind of avoiding litigation, the guidance and the recommendation here is where you want somebody to do something and it's mandatory, say must. If it's prohibited, say must not. And we keep it simple there. And this probably explains why over the course of time, there's a lot of federal agencies that have not been as deliberate in their responsibilities with protecting the information systems and the data and everything under their purview. The other thing that comes to mind there is with regards to, you know, critical infrastructure here, which is the second aspect of what I wanted to talk about today. In the context of critical infrastructure, and, you know, we talked about this was Infrastructure Security Month, there is some debate about what exactly is critical infrastructure. And it's a very valid argument in a lot of senses. And I think it's a conversation that every information security professional, risk management professional needs to be involved in because we're not all speaking the same language. And at least here in the United States, there's a document referred to as Presidential Policy Directive 21 regarding critical infrastructure sectors. There's a bunch of them, and typical government fashion is they list them all, then there's some subsectors within that. It's worth spending the time to talk about that because this year in particular, we saw some very disturbing attacks, right? This isn't the first time they've come up. We've seen some other ones happen across the globe that were, you know, largely believed to be government involved or intelligence based or whatnot. But this year was the year of the marked stepped increase, if you will, on ransomware attacks and really kind of shuttering a lot of capabilities. We had supply chain issues. We've had issues on fuel delivery systems. We've had incidents on food supply. And I want, you know, and really for the balance of this podcast here is really, you know, us to challenge some norms with this because in particular earlier this year, the Black Matter attacked a farming co-op. And from some of the reporting that was out there and whatnot, there was some spirited debate about whether or not a farming co-op is considered critical infrastructure. And here within the United States, it is the way that it's categorized. You go look at that document, the PPD 21, it'll give you all these different things. You know, there's a chemical sector, a commercial facility sector, communications, critical manufacturing, dams, the defense industrial base, emergency services, energy, financial services, food and agriculture, which is where this one lie, government facilities, healthcare and public health, IT, nuclear reactors, materials and waste, transportation systems, and water and wastewater systems. And collectively, that's a lot of stuff, right? It, all of the things that if we think about what has really become necessitated the modern way of living, if you will. First and foremost, I think is we need to acknowledge that, and I don't believe that the United States is surely alone in this. The United States government, and I would argue that most other governments do not holistically provide all the critical services to their people. It's just not happening. And at least here in the U.S., the government has historically not been very efficient at doing things. And if you want it done efficiently or cost effectively, that's typically why, you know, where the private sector comes in and they help out. With regards to, you know, the things that government is expected to do, if the government doesn't do it, then they're potentially are going to partner or they're going to outsource it via any kind of contracting vehicles that are out there. And this continues to really muddy the waters, to be honest with you, because there's a lot of private industry that has become an extension of the government. And I don't believe the United States is alone in this. I'm sure that there's others. And you look at everything that is coming into play here with chemicals, right? Sure, the agency that is oversees the chemical sectors is Department of Homeland Security. But if we look about the things that are in there, all these raw materials that go into the global chain, and they talk about basic chemicals, specialty chemicals, agriculture, and whatnot, the government's not producing those. It's a lot of private businesses. So you see how all of a sudden that truly a lot of companies, enterprises, or, you know, entities, whether they're public, private, or, you know, to include the nonprofits that are out there, are part of the supply chain, a critical supply chain, and therefore, at least in the context of the United States, are critical infrastructure. I don't think that the U.S. has done a very good job articulating that. PPD 21, unless you're really working in any of those sectors and involved at the at sector level stuff where you're working with like the information sharing analysis centers or whatnot, the ISACs, and talking to your colleagues that are in those industries as to what they're seeing or whatnot. I'm not sure a lot of people pay a lot of attention to this document, which is, again, it's not really surprising, but it's one of those things that we need to continue to advance it because that's really going to be a dynamic document. And that's proven actually with an article I found, it was actually yesterday, by a press release that the Intelligence and National Security Alliance, which is a trade group for intelligence and national security communities here, they wrote a white paper arguing that the federal government should be classifying space systems as critical infrastructure. So that kind of just reinforces the fact that this document is a dynamic living document, and over time, as they append to that, there's an outreach component of that. The U.S. beliefs on cyber and everything aren't always shared by some of the other countries and whatnot, and they have their own ideas of how to do things. But we need to get to a point where there's a common lexicon, right? And this language of, you know, what's inbound, what's out of bounds. And in the case of Black Matter here, right, they actually put on their, on their website, right, that they don't hit critical infrastructure. So reasonable, you know, a person is going to sit here and be like, well, they probably are only viewing like electricity and fuel delivery and stuff like that. It's kind of hard to fathom how food's not part of supply chain or, you know, critical infrastructure in particular. But for anybody who's a history buff and understanding, you know, the different types of governmental makeups that are out there and whatnot, whether you're, you know, any variant of a democracy or communism or any of that other stuff, like there's just different beliefs on some of this stuff. And at some point we need to come to some common understanding. Otherwise, it's going to really be a free for all. We've seen, you know, these cyber attacks continue to escalate. The ransomware, this was, you know, a really terrible year. There's been a lot of debate about paying for ransoms or whatnot. One universally held belief, right, is that you're emboldening the bad actors when you pay. And from those that I follow in the industry, the resounding theme is that if you pay once, you're probably going to get hit again because they know you were willing to pay the first time. So you're probably willing to, you're going to pay for a second time. The second thing is that these, you know, bad actors really, whatever their motivation, it's kind of hard to and probably not prudent to think that any of them are going to stand by their word. So if they say, hey, if you pay this ransom, we're going to, you know, we'll give you the unlock key and we promise we didn't release your data, chances are that's not going to hold true. And so it just kind of comes back to this resiliency, the state of resiliency that we have to have and to go it alone and kind of make sure that you're doing all of the right things. So for the consultants out there, you know, that are listening and you're engaging with a lot of companies, I'm hoping today's podcast kind of at least resurface maybe some concerns you already had or some thoughts that you had. The other thing is just to kind of, you know, just to put a bow on this particular podcast so far is that, you know, you can't legislate morals. And I know that there's some out there that you know, think that it's possible. I am not of that mindset. Here in the United States, we have lots of laws. Laws are broken all the time. And the fact that we had to, you know, we have to have laws and we have to have directives and all these things to kind of compel people to do their job increasingly makes me skeptical, right, about everything that we're doing. Make no, you know, I have no doubts that we are much better today than we were 10 years ago. However, there's a lot of things that are still happening today. A lot of these cyber incidents that continue to occur that are they're truly preventable in a lot of cases. The goal, right, is to make it more expensive for the bad actors to accomplish what it is they're trying to do. Contrary to popular belief, like not every cyber attack is an APT, right? That takes a lot of resources, a lot of time, and a lot of effort, and a lot of just, you know, a lot of companies are just not going to be worth that kind of investment. So making sure that you're doing, you know, getting back to basics, those things that they consider, you know, cyber hygiene, we'll kind of dive into some of those things in future podcasts. To kind of wrap this up, when I opened, you know, I talked about a different look, you know, to the podcast or whatnot. I expect, you know, my perspective is there's value in talking about current events and articles and articles of interest, kind of drum up some interest here. Similarly, I touched on how I just absolutely thrive on the workforce education and development side of the things. That's really my particular sweet spot. I love having those conversations and ideally helping ISOCA bring actionable information out there that we can make marked improvements to really kind of start to even out this supply-demand imbalance that largely exists. As part of that, I'm going to be bringing on some respected people that I hold in high regard that I've come across over the years. and just talk about various subjects, and whether it's strategy or operational stuff or whatnot. I think that we just, the more comprehensive we of content that we're bringing out here, the better off we all are to kind of supplement some of the more formal content creation that we're doing here at Isoca. So with that, until the next podcast, I appreciate you tuning in, listening. And if you have any feedback, please reach out to Isoca and you can communicate a message back. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To listen to more podcasts from Isoca, please visit isoca.org/podcast. Don't forget to subscribe for upcoming episodes.